People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, regulating currently illegal drugs in BC. Cora DeBeck argues it's the way to reduce deaths from drug toxicity. She points to examples of practices we can take from rules around firearms, tobacco, and more. Welcome to People First Radio. Toxic, unregulated drugs were responsible for more than 2,500 deaths in the province of BC last year. BC Emergency Health Services responded to more than 42,000 overdose or drug poisoning patient events in the same time span. My guest on today's show argues that drug prohibition is fueling the crisis and that regulating drugs is the way out. Over the course of the program, I'll ask Simon Fraser University's Cora DeBeck what exactly that means and what drug regulation could look like.
I'm Cora DeBeck. I'm an associate professor in the School of Public Policy at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, BC. I'm also a CIHR Applied Public Health Chair and a Dorothy Killam Fellow. I've been doing research on substance use and drug policy for over 15 years, and I'm really excited to have this conversation with you.
And you've also, well, thank you very much for making some time. You've also written recently calling for drug regulation in an article co-authored with Dr. Perry Kendall. In the conversation, what is the problem that you think specifically drug regulation would solve?
Yeah, so the high level main problem I see right now is the catastrophic number of overdose deaths that we're experiencing. BC has been in a public health crisis since 2016 from the toxic, unregulated drug supply. And the numbers are really holding steady years and years later. And what we know from coroner's data, from a whole body of research, is that the supply of drugs is toxic, and it's fentanyl that is primarily responsible for the overdose fatalities that we're seeing. And so we need to do something about the supply of drugs. And from a public health evidence-based perspective and looking at the research and evidence, to me, drug regulation is really the way out here. I would also add, in terms of the architecture of drug criminalization and drug prohibition, there are a huge host of other harms, not just related to the toxic drug supply and overdose death, but when we look at the costs associated with criminalizing people, incarcerating people, the money that goes into drug law enforcement, there's really just been decades of research stacked on top of each other, making a very compelling case that the war on drugs has been a failure on a huge number of levels, for individuals, for communities, for the general public. And we really need to imagine a transformative change and a way out of the situation that we're in.
Before we get further into maybe some of the why, would you be able to explain some of the what? What does drug regulation look like in your kind of ideal world?
Great. I mean, one thing I would start with is what it doesn't look like. And what it doesn't look like is decriminalization or just plain regulation without any controls. The key part of drug regulation is that it allows us to use a whole host of tools to monitor and shape the production, the distribution, and how people access currently illegal drugs. So drug regulation looks like having strict health and safety standards around products that are being produced. So any illicit drugs that are being currently illicit drugs that are being produced, if it was brought under a regulated market, there would be very strict controls and safety regulations on what's being produced. So we wouldn't have this toxic, unregulated supply of drugs that's killing people. The other thing that regulation looks like is a whole host of tools to manage who has access to these products. So sometimes it's helpful to think about other kinds of substances. And so one area that we can think of is when we look at tobacco control. We have a strict regulations around how tobacco is packaged, how it's accessed. We use price, age restrictions. We have education campaigns. There's tons of regulatory tools that we've used around tobacco, which, you know, looking at the evidence in the last couple decades, use of tobacco has gone way down. The harms of tobacco use from a public health perspective have gone way down. So public health-based regulations can be very effective tools in limiting access and regulating access and shaping people's consumption habits. So regulation would look different for different kinds of substances. There's different tools, different approaches we can use. Again, kind of thinking about what it looks like for alcohol regulation. I think that's an example where we have some lessons to draw on what we should not do. For instance, we should not let companies come in and make a huge amount of profit and try to increase alcohol consumption or the consumption of any good. Alcohol has been heavily promoted. It is in terms of the actual production. I mean, it is, people do know what they're consuming. They know the alcohol content. People aren't dying from unknown poisonings from alcohol, like what was reported during alcohol prohibition back in the day. But we don't want to get into a situation where currently illegal drugs become, you know, promoted and taken over by companies that want to make money. From a public health perspective, that would not be good. So again, regulation, it would be very complex for different types of drugs. I think we have lots of lessons to draw on from alcohol, from tobacco, from cannabis, even from things like firearms. You know, we have a lot of regulatory tools around who can access firearms, how that works in terms of registries, in terms of having skills, safety courses that need to be completed. So one of the challenges, I think, with drug regulation is that we haven't been able to try out these different models because everything has been so restricted and is in just this, you know, illegal prohibited status. But there's lots of alternatives to the current situation that we're in. You know, I think we need to really look at these very seriously.
Would it be fair to say that you feel like maybe the reason we have a lot of the harms related to drug use in the first place is because there's this organized criminal element basically directing the supply with very little oversight, and that the idea of a regulatory model is to get rid of that, basically, to eliminate the negative elements of substance use that don't necessarily have to do with the specific consequences of the substance?
Yeah. So there's a large body of research that has really documented how so many of the harms associated with substance use are directly linked to drug prohibition and the fact that it is criminalized. So in many areas of research, there's, for instance, looking at stigma. So people, when a drug is criminalized, there's a lot of stigma associated with its use. And when people feel stigmatized, they're very reluctant to seek out help, to go to health services, to talk with friends, to talk with family, and to get help. So one of the areas that drug criminalization is particularly harmful is around that piece of stigma and pushing people away from health and social services and various types of things. And as I was describing before, too, the reason that the supply of drugs is so toxic is because it's not regulated. So that is certainly something that regulation and having health and safety standards around the production and distribution of drugs would address. there are, you know, very complex reasons why people use substances. Under a regulatory framework, there still would be people who would have problematic relationships with substances. You know, we see that with alcohol. We see that in many other areas. And, you know, hopefully under a regulated framework, we would be able to, you know, better support and divert funds, for instance, away from law enforcement into health and social services and those types of things that help people. But, you know, I think the reality is that people do use drugs. Drug prevention is very important, but people do use drugs, and addiction treatment is very important, but it just hasn't been, it's not effective for a lot of people. Recovery is often a very long journey for people. And so, you know, in a regulatory framework, I don't think we're going to be able to, you know, the goal is not to stop all drug use, but it is to try and contain and shape and guide substance use away from the harms that we are seeing.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest is Cora DeBeck. She's a Canadian Institutes of Health Researcher's Applied Public Health Chair in addressing the toxic drug crisis for young people who use drugs in British Columbia. We're talking about the idea of drug regulation. How could we create a regulatory framework that is sort of permissive enough to get rid of the criminal elements supplying the drugs, but not so permissive that maybe people who wouldn't otherwise have experienced harms from using these drugs now access them?
Yes, that is the exact fine line that you know, from my perspective, public health, public policy needs to walk. So we want to have it be restrictive enough that we are deterring people from using drugs. Things like high price, age restrictions, areas of restrictions on where drugs can be consumed are strategies that have been used for alcohol and tobacco that could be used for currently illegal drugs. And so we want to be able to constrain as much as we can. And then there is a point which nobody really knows where it is. And that's, regulation does take trial and error. But if things are too highly regulated, it does create or essentially sort of push people into an unregulated environment. And so one of the things we've seen with cannabis regulation, particularly my understanding is in California and things, and I think BC as well, although I'm not as familiar with some of that data, but restrictions were so tight around the production and sale of regulated cannabis that a lot of people just went to the illegal market. And so those are the kinds of balances and the kinds of challenges that we will encounter with regulation. Each substance is going to be different. Different market forces are going to come into play, and they're going to change over time. So once we have one model, it doesn't mean that that's, you know, going to last in the next 5-10 years. These things will require consistent monitoring and evaluating and reshaping and enforcement. I mean, all regulations need enforcement in order to be effective. So it's certainly a large undertaking. It's not, I wouldn't put it forward as an easy kind of endeavor, but when we look at the catastrophic failure that prohibition has been, how costly it is from a public perspective of how much money goes into law enforcement and prisons and incarceration, and then from a perspective of the overdose crisis and how many people are dying from a toxic drug supply, I think there's a, from my perspective, absolutely enough rationale to move in this direction and to figure out what that balance is. And it will be through some trial and error and correction and monitoring and evaluation.
On that front, you wrote in the article that illegal drugs are easy to find regardless of their illegal status. Is that something that, you know, anyone seems to be attempting to make any attempts to address right now?
You know, there's basically two primary objectives of drug prohibition, which is to eliminate the supply and eliminate the demand of drugs. And neither one has been even close to being achieved. The supply of drugs, if anything, prohibition has a perverse effect in terms of making the production of drugs incredibly lucrative. So there's a lot of incentives for people to go into the illicit market and produce drugs, and to make them very easily available. People who are dealing drugs in an illicit market don't care about the age of people who are purchasing or at what time or any of those types of things. Their incentive is to make drugs as available as possible, and they're very good at that. There certainly are people who are deterred from using drugs because they are illegal and don't want to risk having a criminal record or any kind of run-ins with the police. But looking at the number of people who do use drugs, some of the estimates that I've heard from public health in BC is that as many as 225,000 people in British Columbia use illicit drugs currently. So it certainly hasn't, prohibition hasn't been successful in reducing that demand and availability of drugs.
In having a lot of conversations on this subject, I almost take away the impression that for people who haven't had experience with substance use versus for people who currently are using substances, it almost seems like rules that would benefit one group would kind of necessarily impact the other. Does that make sense? I don't know. Is that a kind of a fair takeaway? And how do you kind of navigate that doing research in this field?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one thing that I do know from looking at alcohol is that when we make alcohol low cost and easily available, generally consumption of alcohol goes up and public health harms associated with alcohol go up. So I don't see from a public health perspective, there is a risk of, we don't want an environment where any kind of drug is low cost and easily available. From my perspective, that's exactly what regulation is trying to address. Because when we regulate substances, we have the most tools to put containments on who can access things and where. Again, it's always a fine balance. The more restrictive you are, the more you're likely to see an illicit market come up. But, that is the purpose of regulation. With respect to whether there's a direct conflict between those who currently don't use drugs, I think there's a lot of assumptions in there and with respect to why and how people have problematic relationships with drugs. And there's lots of people who drink alcohol who don't have a problematic relationship with alcohol. And there's lots of people who drink alcohol and end up having a very problematic relationship with alcohol. With illicit drugs, I think that there are more people than we think that use illicit drugs and don't have a problematic relationship with them. It's something that they find, some pleasure and they're able to manage it. So one of the things we see in research around problematic relationships with substances is often it's highly linked with things like early childhood trauma, with poverty, and BC in particularly the legacy of colonization and residential schools and factors like that. And so the baseline sort of availability of substances, while we do have evidence that it is important, is not the determining factor from my read of research evidence and what's out there of why people develop problematic substance relationships with substances. And so, regulating their access, we don't want them to be, promoted and made, very easily available. And at the same time, I think we have to be very, a little bit more nuanced in our thinking about how people and why people have problematic relationships with substances. And it's not because they're just right there and easily available. There are often very many other kinds of factors that are driving that we can address and that we should be addressing through social supports and other kinds of public policy, social determinants of health type interventions.
We've been discussing maybe substances or drugs a lot in our conversation. Are there any important nuances maybe about the different particular substances, specifically as it relates to potential regulation that you think it's important the general public is aware of?
I just think not all drugs are the same. They have different pharmacological aspects. Some produce very intense physical dependence. Others do not. So they're certainly not. When we look at regulation, it wouldn't be a one size fits all. These kinds of approaches, I think, need to be incredibly tailored to different types of drugs. There's, you know, quite a bit of evidence in terms of the, you know, potential harms related to drugs. While we know that there's a large body of evidence that most of the harms associated with drugs are, as you were alluding to, linked to the system of criminalization. But there are physiological impacts of these, of different substances that vary. So, you know, a drug like, opiates, where you quite quickly develop a physical dependence, that compared to a drug like psilocybin or magic mushrooms are essentially very different and have very different risk profiles. And so the kinds of regulatory tools, I think, need to address that and respond to those differences.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh, and I'm speaking with Cora DeBeck. She works in the School of Public Policy at Simon Fraser University, specializing in substance use and drug policy. She's recently argued in favor of drug regulation in an article you can read online in The Conversation. You're also the principal investigator of a study of more than 1,000 street-involved youth who use drugs in Vancouver. First of all, I want to get into that and talk about maybe some of the research and the findings, but I may be curious about just the human element, what you've picked up from interacting with youth using drugs in Vancouver.
Yeah, I mean, I would say in terms of my interactions and relationships with young people who use drugs and young adults who use drugs is a profound respect for their experiences and their struggles. The ways that our society and systems, I think, have let them down repeatedly is frustrating. I think the current policy environment, where for the most part the primary response to substance use continues to be criminalization, despite having things like supervised consumption facilities and naloxone and different types of harm reduction, and boosting addiction treatment and various things. When it really comes down to it, what I hear from them that they feel most is a criminalization and a structural marginalization. There's been a lot of talk in BC, many rounds of discussion around things like forced addiction treatment for young people. So sometimes it's called secure care or secure care. And so it's, you know, essentially forcing young people who use drugs into addiction treatment as a form of protection and safety. And for them, those feel like incredible betrayals of their lives and their agency. And you know, when they are ready to seek help or go to addiction treatment, often the kinds of treatments that they're offered are woefully inadequate. They may go to an addiction treatment center, go for detox, and then come out with, you know, essentially sort of nothing, no direction in their lives, you know, probably no housing, very little community, you know, no job. And so, you know, the way that we have been supporting and responding to these young people is pretty heartbreaking and frustrating.
What has your research shown about maybe why and how young people start using drugs?
Yeah, so our research is survey-based, so it's not quite as rich as qualitative type data where we would be, you know, sitting down and having interviews with young people. But based on our surveys and asking about early childhood experiences and various things, a big factor that comes up is early childhood trauma. Also, a lot of participants in our study have been involved in the child welfare system. A lot have had engagement and interactions with the criminal justice system. And a lot of our participants are identify as Indigenous and have had for many of those young people have been in government care. And we've found that is it directly related to their parents and grandparents having been in residential schools. So a real intergenerational impact of residential schools and really continuing today with the child welfare system. You know, for many of these young people, they don't have housing, they don't have connections with their family, and they're really, really struggling. I hear from some of them, this isn't on our survey, but just in talking with them, is they often describe their substance use as something that is helping them cope with a very challenging context of trauma, of marginalization. And, you know, for them in those contexts, substance use isn't a problem. You know, their problem at that point is entrenched poverty, you know, not having hope for having a job or, you know, sort of sustainable kind of future. So the kinds of reasons that some young people go into substance use and the kind of impact they see it has on their life, for some of them, they really describe it as something that is helping them. For others, they do really want to distance themselves from substance use. They don't want to continue to use substances, and they are really caught, and they're struggling, and they're wanting more help and more support to change the track of their lives.
Earlier this year, I spoke with Dania Fast, and we were speaking about an ethnography she wrote, essentially, of young people who use drugs in Vancouver. And one of the big things I took away from that conversation was it seemed like for a lot of people, substance use kind of gave their day-to-day life a sort of momentum and a goal and a purpose, such that when they kind of did everything the system told them to do to stop using drugs, they were just like really profoundly bored and sort of didn't really have any short or medium term hope, if that makes sense. Is that a theme that you've been able to observe from some of your work in this?
Yeah, we haven't been able to get into that kind of richness with our survey-based data, but I'm familiar with Dr. Fast's work. And I mean, it is a very consistent with, you know, that some of the things we see in our data are, you know, young people that engage with addiction treatment, that go to addiction treatment, and the extent to which that results in long-term cessation from substance use is very rare, unfortunately. So, you know, we see a lot of young people seeking treatment, but not sticking with it. And ultimately continuing to use drugs and to be at risk for overdose fatalities and other harms associated with substance use. So Dania Fast's work certainly is aligned with many of the studies that we've done, but I think gives another level of richness and context to the kind of numbers that we're seeing, or the sort of signals we see in our quantitative survey-based data.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, I'm talking drug regulation with Cora DeBeck. She's an associate professor in the School of Public Policy at Simon Fraser University. She's also a CIHR, Applied Public Health Chair. CIHR is the Government of Canada's health research agency. So recently in BC, we've sort of had this experience with decriminalization. What, from your perspective as a researcher into this, how do you kind of look at what's unfolded with that?
With decriminalization? Yeah, great, great question. Decriminalization is something that the community of people who use drugs have been calling for. Academics have been calling for it. There's been various sort of international commissions and various things that have called for it. As from my perspective, a bit of a low-hanging fruit of trying to respond to this overwhelming body of evidence that drug criminalization and the war on drugs hasn't worked. And it's I think it's seen as, you know, the sort of first step that can be taken towards trying to reverse some of those harms of criminalization. I think one of the challenges with decriminalization is it is such a small, really tiny part of the whole or architecture of drug prohibition and criminalization. So in BC, what was decriminalized was the personal possession of small amounts of drugs. So it was 2.5 grams of drugs cumulatively. And the big challenge with that, with respect to being a policy intervention, is that practically for, like, on the ground, on a societal level, very few people were being charged for drug possession. Prosecutors had given very clear guidelines to frontline police officers that, you know, arresting and charging people for possessing drugs was not a priority, not something that they would move forward with in the court. So it didn't happen often. But one of the changes that decriminalization did bring was that police were then no longer able to seize people's drugs under that small amount, which is in fact an incredibly profound change for a group of people who have been so criminalized and marginalized, to know that, you know, the substance that is going to take away your acute withdrawal symptoms that are horrifyingly uncomfortable, that no one can take that away from you as you've just, you know, purchased it and walked away. So I don't want to undermine or discount the real impact that it does have for people. But when we think about the broader aspect of criminalization, it's such a small piece. So it's really much more of a symbolic gesture. That's how I really saw it from the start, and a really important one, because I think it does acknowledge what a absolute catastrophic failure criminalization has been. The unfortunate events in BC, I think, were that decriminalization came into effect, and at the same time, we have a catastrophic housing crisis. The supply of drugs has continued to deteriorate and become more toxic, and things like benzodiazepines are now very common in the drug supply. And the kind of effect that this has for people in terms of their, you know, just ability to manage their day-to-day life, their substance use becomes much more visible to people. And so I think that the public's perception of street disorder was that it was increasing, and they very wrongly attributed that to decriminalization. Street disorder, there's lots of evidence that it is very clearly linked to people's housing status. Public drug use is very linked to housing status and whether people have another option or another location to go. And people in BC just, you know, really didn't have those other options. And so I think decriminalization was then seen as this driver of street disorder. I don't think the police and law enforcement throughout BC were entirely transparent when they were, I think they came, some bodies came forward and said, you know, we no longer have any tools to manage public substance use, and there's nothing that we can do, and that's why it's gone, it's increased. And, you know, that's just not true. They certainly do have, you know, in on any transit, people can be, you know, there's no substance use allowed ever under decrim or not under decrim on transit systems and in people's place of business. So I think it was a bit of a disingenuous kind of message that was given to the public, that was not, there was no evidence provided that this was actually the case. And so now that decrim in Vancouver, or sorry, in BC has been, you know, really fundamentally changed in terms of now, you know, no one is able to possess drugs in public. They can only do so in their homes, or if they're unhoused, and then they can have them in those, you know, cases. And I think it's been a real disservice to the public in terms of what how to manage substance use. And I'm quite frustrated that was the kind of narrative that happened and the kind of understanding that the public took from decriminalization. So I'm quite discouraged and upset that you know, the media and other people who and politicians, I think, who should know better, kind of scapegoated decriminalization when, you know, housing and the toxic drug supply are by far the largest contributors to that that challenge.
So our conversation today opened with the idea of creating a sort of regulatory framework for currently illegal substances. How do you think what happened with decriminalization informs how you could see that, if you could see that, taking place on some kind of time horizon in BC or in Canada?
I suspect that one of the barriers to moving forward with drug regulation is that it's really hard for people to picture it. I think for most, when you look at the broad evidence around the war on drugs and criminalization and prohibition, I think people can pretty clearly see that it's been a failure. There's just the overwhelming evidence. I have a hard time believing that someone can say it has been a success, because it really clearly hasn't been a success. But then I think the general public has a hard time really picturing what else something could look like. And the need to look at different models and really, I think, help people to envision and see how it could work, and that, you know, we wouldn't follow, and as I don't think we should follow the model of alcohol regulation, where we have liquor stores and things are highly promoted and we have all these advertisements and you know, huge companies behind them making exorbitant amounts of money. That's not the kind of model that we should go to. And looking at things like, you know, how we do regulate firearms. So what are some of the successes from regulating tobacco in terms of, you know, how it's been packaged and priced and you know, the restrictions on sale and places of consumption and those types of things. So I hope that by helping the public picture what these kinds of tools could look like, that maybe we'll have a little bit more openness to try these kinds of things. And I think also really bringing people back. One aspect that I think we really need to focus on as a long-term strategy is drug prevention education in schools. And not necessarily because I think drug prevention education is particularly effective in, you know, given what we know of the broader social determinants of health, but I think it shapes our as a collective community, our understanding of substance use. And right now, one of the very common types of drug education is things like DARE, where law enforcement is coming into schools and you know, talking about, you know, just say no to drugs, and it's quite moralizing and individual focused of it's, you know, individual people's personal responsibility to say no. And if you don't say no, then you're, you know, sort of responsible for what happens. I think if we had a drug education kind of intervention and curriculum where young people understood the full spectrum of the risks and potential benefits of substance use, lots of the, you know, the driving factors behind why people use drugs and how they have problematic relationships with drugs and what kind of supports would be available. You know, I think as a collective society, I think we might be in a better position to imagine what a regulated framework would look like, and one that's not so reliant on shame and blame and criminalization.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Cora DeBeck argues that drug prohibition is fueling the overdose crisis and that regulating drugs is the way out. We're going to return to our conversation in a moment, but first I want to take you back to a conversation I had in February 2022 with another Simon Fraser University professor, Neil Boyd. We were talking about decriminalization, but this was back before BC's decriminalization pilot was even announced.
If we have a form of decriminalization where once you have the drug, you know, nobody can touch you. Well, that might have some significantly positive consequences, but we've still got this problem of, well, how do you get the drug? And most important, the issue we're facing now is a toxic drug supply. So we don't have to surrender the drug supply to the illegal marketplace. We can regulate that market as we have with other drugs, decriminalization is not going to meet that challenge. Decriminalization of possession is not going to meet that challenge.
Boyd was also calling for drug regulation. He spoke about the history of how some substances became criminalized in Canada.
You know, we already have regulated a number of fairly dangerous drugs, if you like, in alcohol and tobacco. And if we look back at the history, that is, why was it that smoking opium was criminalized back in 1908 in Canada? Why was it that cocaine was added to that list in 1911, cannabis in 1923? The history has nothing to do with public health. It had to do with a riot on the west coast of Canada that was economically motivated and racist in its intent, that began with the Asiatic riot of 1907 and the looting of Japanese and Chinese businesses in the city of Vancouver. The statement that was made at the time that we first criminalized smoking opium was, we will get some good out of this riot yet. The legislation was introduced by the Minister of Labor, a recognition and an acknowledgement, if you like, in retrospect, that this was all about a problem of labor, a problem of race. It had nothing to do with public health. If we were to sit down today and make judgments about the regulation of drugs and which drugs we would permit in our culture, we would probably do things very differently. But I'll step back from that just to say, we now are beginning to wonder as a society whether we should use criminal prohibition as a response to drug use and drug distribution. Well, drug distribution, we can regulate. We regulate tobacco, we regulate alcohol, we regulate cannabis, and my view is that we ought to decriminalize all forms of drug use and regulate access. That will give us less difficulty than what we are now doing.
What do you think it would take to accomplish the reforms you're suggesting are necessary?
Well, I think we need a regulated market. I think we had that until 100 years ago. There was no talk of criminalization of drugs. If you go back, as I did a number of years ago, to look at the origins of substance criminalization globally, it began in 1908 with the Shanghai Opium Commission. And at that commission, there was a heated debate between Britain, which wanted some form of regulation, and the United States, which wanted a kind of global prohibition. That was based on highly moralistic and religious grounds. And of course, the United States carried the day in that debate, and we are all living with the consequences of that. So I do think we need to return, but I don't think we want to have a totally laissez-faire system, which we can see did exist prior to 1908, where we had patent medicine manufacturers, you know, basically telling you that you don't need to go to a doctor, here's some opium, that'll be a cure for your problem. So promoting in an indiscriminate manner the use of opiates without the consumers really having knowledge of the risks of dependence. So we don't want that. We want a regulated market, and I think we would be much better off if we moved in that direction. I don't think that's coming soon, but I have to say that 10 years ago, I didn't think we'd legalize cannabis in my lifetime, and now that's happened. So there's a growing understanding that the line that we drew between legal and illegal drugs back more than 100 years ago was a line that had nothing to do with public health and everything to do with politics, economics, and culture.
That was part of a conversation I had with Neil Boyd, now a professor emeritus at Simon Fraser University. He was speaking with me back in February 2022 about drug decriminalization and regulation. Now I'm going to get you back to my talk with Cora DeBeck. Reminder, she's a Canadian Institute of Health Researchers, public health chair, and an associate professor at Simon Fraser University. We've been discussing her recent call for drug regulation. So the idea there being you feel like we need more or perhaps more effective drug education that is more so about like these are the specific substances, these are the long-term potential effects of using them, that sort of thing?
Yeah, and that, you know, that it's not an individual moral failing that someone would become dependent on substances. You know, bringing in discussions around trauma, around intergenerational trauma, around colonization, in working with some young Indigenous people who use drugs, one of the things I have heard is that in many communities, it's still very painful to talk about residential schools and to talk about those kinds of experiences and what impact it had on families and communities. And so some young people don't know or understand what their own family's experience was with residential schools. And so when they do have more of a context and a framework and an understanding, there's a little more understanding of what happened and I think potential for healing and different ways forward. So, you know, I think the school system, having young kids that go to school, I think they're doing a much better job with the history and ongoing acts of colonization and having young people understand those. And I think that's an area where we can, you know, continue to do more and do better.
And a few times in our conversation today, you've talked about maybe tobacco and firearm regulations as places we could look to if we were trying to create a regulatory framework for substances. What are some of the specific measures that each of those do that you think would kind of hop over well to a substance model?
Yeah, I mean, for one, just to say, I mean, regulation, is, I see it as a very important area for development, but it's not something that I've, you know, sort of dedicated my research expertise to. So these are, you know, very preliminary thoughts. And I think there are people who, you know, have their study regulation in there for their whole careers and would have a much better sense of how these kinds of tools could be best implemented and adapted and used. But some of the things that I'm aware of with firearms regulation are things like you have to take a safety course. So there's a knowledge-based kind of, you know, exam that you have to pass in terms of knowing about the you know, I'm assuming that I've never taken it, I've never held a gun, but you know, what the risks are, how to be safe around it. You know, there's things like background checks. You know, you would have a you know, a potential license to, you know, or you have to have a license to carry a firearm. I'm aware with gambling that there are things like you can self-identify to be on a no-go list for various casinos in your area if you feel like you have a problem with gambling and you want to, you know, sort of reduce the chances of you, you know, going into a casino and losing your money. So there could potentially be those types of tools with substance use if you want to, you know, put yourself on some no purchase list type thing. With respect to tobacco, even, you know, just things around when we look at the difference between tobacco packaging and alcohol packaging. You know, one is really promoted and one is really made to, you know, look quite innocuous and even have, you know, some graphic pictures around the potential negative impacts. I'm, you know, don't always think gory pictures are particularly effective, and they can be quite stigmatizing in the context of our current framework around illicit substance use. But if we were to move into another world of regulation, I think other things that right now wouldn't work could come on the table and could work in a different kind of context. So I certainly don't have all the answers of what the perfect regulatory balance would be for each substance, but I know there are brilliant people in our communities and in our, you know, collective circles that would be able to come up with at least a starting place. And then I think a key thing throughout all of it would be very close monitoring and evaluation and tweaks and changes in terms of, you know, what things cost and, you know, hours of operation and those types of things. And, you know, I imagine too, there's going to be sort of regiment for the broader public. And then for people who have, you know, very acute dependencies, maybe they would have a different kind of framework or management kind of case management type thing. So I think there's lots of different ways that we could do this.
You're tuned in to People First Radio. More than 2,500 people died last year in BC as a result of unregulated drug toxicity. BC Emergency Health Services responded to more than 42,000 drug poisoning events last year. Cora DeBeck argues that prohibition is fueling the crisis and that drug regulation is the way out. DeBeck is a CIHR Applied Public Health Chair in addressing the toxic drug crisis for young people who use drugs in British Columbia. The CIHR is the Government of Canada's health research agency. And I guess it's true that even for the things we do already regulate, like alcohol, like cigarettes, there are kind of always ongoing efforts to change those regulations, to consider like, oh, maybe we want to let people have a drink in the park, or maybe, you know, the individual cigarettes need a warning on them as well. So I guess that's one of the things you're saying, is that not knowing the perfect system right off the hop doesn't mean we should never try anything. Is that basically the idea here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And you know, we won't get it right away. It will require, you know, changes and revisions, and all of these things are, you know, we're going to be constantly trying to balance between shutting down the illicit market and the illicit system. And so it will certainly require tweaks and balances. You know, I'm aware of in some places, I heard from a colleague, I don't know for sure, but I heard from a colleague in Australia about tobacco, and that they have restricted, or they have, the price of tobacco has gone so high that there is a much larger illicit market for tobacco, and violence around the underground tobacco market there. And so I think that's, you know, another reminder that, you know, you do constantly have to balance and course correct, because, you know, this isn't a global market of supply and demand, and there are many different interests involved. So that would be an ongoing factor that wouldn't go away.
We've talked about a whole lot of different stuff in various levels of detail. Do you think there are any maybe big ideas that you really think you want the general public to take away or be more aware of?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it, for me, the biggest points and themes, I mean, from a perspective of living in BC, I think really remembering and grounding our understanding of colonization and what that has done to the First Nations and Indigenous peoples on these lands is very intricately connected to substance use and drug policy and the overdose crisis. And so I think really, you know, urging the public to, if they don't know much about our history of colonization and the ongoing impacts, and, you know, how even just the ongoing removal of Indigenous children and the child welfare system and inadequacies within that system are continuing to perpetuate inequities, that's something that people should really take the initiative to learn more about and understand more about. And in terms of, you know, thinking very critically about the idea that you know, people who use drugs have a moral failing and are, you know, responsible for their current condition. I really urge people to, you know, educate themselves more about, there's a huge source of lots of information available around many of the sort of risk factors for problematic substance use. And so much of it does come back and link to trauma and poverty and structural marginalization. And so, you know, moving away from a moralizing and blaming kind of framework, I think, is really important and something to reflect on and consider. And I think, you know, in terms of, you know, any of these ideas around moving forward or understanding the problem, one thing that I certainly would, you know, emphasize is the importance of listening to and including people who use drugs in these kinds of conversations and in understanding what is happening. People who use drugs are incredibly articulate and have the most direct expertise on the challenges that they're facing and the kinds of things they need. And so I think, you know, there's lots of understanding of sort of a call to action of nothing about us without us. And so ensuring that we're including people with lived or living experience of substance use or community experts and Indigenous communities as well, in terms of how we can move forward and address the challenges that we're living with right now.
Cora Beck, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Great. Thanks for the opportunity. It was great to connect.
Cora DeBeck is an associate professor in the School of Public Policy at Simon Fraser University. She's also a Canadian Institutes of Health Researchers Applied Public Health Chair in addressing the toxic drug crisis for young people who use drugs in British Columbia. You can read more about her call for drug regulation in an article co-authored with Dr. Perry Kendall, BC's former provincial health officer. The article is published in The Conversation. It's titled, "Drug Prohibition is Fueling the Overdose Crisis. Regulating drugs is the way out."
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
There's just a smidge of time left on today's program. I want to use it to bring you a stat that will be particularly relevant if you're listening in Nanaimo. At a city council meeting there this week, there was ample discussion, as city council agreed, with some conditions, to lease a site to BC Housing for a facility to create 60 spaces for people currently experiencing homelessness. At one point during the discussion, City Councilor Paul Manley shared a figure about how the percentage of people experiencing homelessness in Nanaimo who are sleeping unsheltered compares to other communities.
In our last point in time count, we had 515 people identified as homeless. Of those 515 people, 78% of them had no access to any form of shelter at all. The three BC housing or three BC ministries, using data that they collect, the RCMP and outreach teams figure that the number is closer to 800 to 1,000 people. So there are people living in vehicles, there's people camped out in our community from the border with Cedar all the way to the border with Lanceville. When you compare that 78% figure of who's unhoused and has no access to shelter in Nanaimo, it is only 15% in Victoria. 15% of people that are unhoused in Victoria have no access to shelter. In Vancouver, it's 30%. In Nanaimo, we are at 78%. And so we have to do whatever we can to assist people on our streets.
Nanaimo City Councilor Paul Manley speaking at a July 8th council meeting. That is it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thank you so much for tuning in. Don't forget the show also exists as a podcast, and I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.